Everyone, we're continuing. We're still in Perek Aleph of Shoftim. If you remember the part of the story at this point, the Psukim are telling us that after Yoshua ben Nun died, there were still large portions of the land of Eretz Yisrael that was not conquered. Part of it was that the Jewish people were not able to conquer it. Part of it was that they were not interested in conquering it. They had enough land for a relatively small population. We're going to see this was a big chet on their part. But the thing to keep in mind is, although much of the land was not conquered, all of the land had been subdivided and allocated. So the Shevatim were given their chalakim, even in land that they had not yet conquered. And the result of that is very pivotal, because once land was assigned to a Shevet, the responsibility of conquering that land was no longer a national responsibility. It became the responsibility of the individual tribe. And thus we find in Perek Aleph and Perek Beis of Shoftim, various tribes, the Shevatim, had an achrayut to conquer their territories, and they either did or they didn't, and were given a listing of what cities they conquered, what cities they didn't. But it no longer becomes a national conquest. It becomes a tribal obligation. Now, we read about the fact that Hebron was one of the cities conquered by the tribe of Yehuda, and we are told that the city of Hebron was given to Kalev ben Yefuneh. This was a special gift that in recognition of his great role, first of all, I mentioned, when the Meraglim were sent, Kalev stopped at Hebron to be mispalel at the graves of Maris and Machpelah, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, the Avos and the Imos. And since Kalev had a special sheiches to that makom tefillah, it was given to him. Now, a little bit of a qualification. The Gemara makes a very interesting point. Hebron was actually one of the 48 cities that were given to the Levim. If you remember, throughout Eretz Yisrael, Levim did not have a distinct territory, but they were given cities interspersed throughout Eretz Yisrael and Eivor HaYarden, a total of 48 cities. And Hebron is actually described as one of the Levite cities. Not only that, it is also an Ir Miklat. If somebody kills accidentally, they would go to Hebron for refuge. And in fact, every Ir Miklat is also a Ore Levium. In fact, Lubavitcher Rebbe had an interesting discussion about the theory of incarceration in Halacha. You know, as you know, Jewish law does not have a prison system per se, but the closest thing to a prison system is the Ir Miklat. The Ir Miklat is, if somebody kills accidentally, he's under city arrest. He's confined to that city until the Kohen Gadol dies, which could either be, you know, one day or 50 years. It's an indeterminate sentence. And he remains there, and he's not allowed to leave the city. The Gemara tells us, by the way, that the mothers of the Kohanim Gadolim used to bring food packages to the people in the Ore Miklat, so they shouldn't pray that the Kohen Gadol dies, so they get out. But be it as it may, the Lubavitcher Rebbe points out that every one of the Ore Miklats was also a city of Levium. Now, who were the Levium? The Levium were the teachers of Am Yisrael. They were the spiritual leaders. Now, when somebody kills, even accidentally, we're not talking about a pure accident. We're talking about negligence, carelessness, going through a red light, not looking at what you're doing. There's a certain character flaw that a person didn't care enough. Because if it's a total accident, you don't go to the Ir Miklat. The Ir Miklat is a shogeg that carries with. Now, these are three terms. Mezid is intentional, premeditated murder. Shogeg is what we would call manslaughter, a certain amount of negligence. And then there's a third category called ones, which is unavoidable accidents. Unavoidable accidents, you don't go to the Ir Miklat. In every case of an Ir Miklat, there is some culpability. So what do you do when you take a person who doesn't have the proper respect and reverence for life? you put him with tzaddikim, you put him with talmidei chachamim, you put him in an environment of kedusha, in the hope that something is going to rub off. As opposed to a typical prison system, where of course the prisoner is put with people who may be a lot worse. And that is why the recidivism rate for prisons, at least in the United States, my guess is it'd be the same for Israel, is very high. Basically, once a person has been in, he's going to come back, because what are you going to learn in prison? You just, oy la Russia, oy la Shechina. Alas to the Russia, alas to the neighbor of the Russia. Right? So the Rabbi Rebbe said that the Torah's theory of incarceration, so to speak, is to put a person with good, positive influences that will lift him up. But why am I mentioning this? Because I'm mentioning this because we seem to have a bit of a discrepancy here. The book of Shoftim tells us that Chevron was given to Kalev. And yet we know elsewhere, from Yoshua, the book of Yoshua actually, that Chevron is an Ir Miklat, and it is one of the Arei Levim, as all the Arei Miklats were. So which was it? So again, the Gemara basically says that Chevron proper is an Ir Miklat and an Arei Levim, but Kalev was given the villages around Chevron, kind of the metropolitan area of Chevron, and that belonged to Kalev. Okay. But again, as I say, Kalev Zechus to have Chevron was connected to his tefillah in Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Now, where we ended off, though, was afterwards, we talk about, right before that, we talk about the conquest by Othniel ben Kenaz of the city that is called Kiryat Sefer. And Kalev was involved in that conquest as well. Kalev said, he who will conquer Kiryat Sefer, I will give Achsa, my daughter, as a bride. And it is recorded, Othniel ben Kenaz conquered Kiryat Sefer, and he married Achsa. Othniel ben Kenaz is described as the younger brother of Kalev. And I think I mentioned that the Gemara asks the Kasha, how can he be Kalev's brother? Othniel's father is Kenaz. Kalev's father is Yefuna. And the Gemara's answer is they were half-brothers, meaning to say that Kalev's mother married, her second husband was Kenaz, so Othniel and Kalev are half-brothers sharing the same mother. And then there's an account here, a curious account, of Achsa complaining to her father, you have not given me wells, you've given me dry land. And Kalev gave her wells. So the whole story is very enigmatic. I just want to repeat a little bit because I'm going to go on to a hemshich of this. The Gemara in Maseches Temura gives a whole midrashic reformulation of this whole story. And it mentions, Othniel ben Kenaz, by the way, became the first shofet after Yoshua, but at this point he was not a shofet. At this point he's private citizen. Maybe he became a shofet by virtue of his conquest of Kiryat Sefer, especially when we consider the Medrash about the meaning of that conquest. And the Gemara in Temura has a whole arichus that as Moshe Rabbeinu was dying, he asked Yoshua, is there any she'ela that you need clarity for? Ask now, because I'm going, I'm leaving. And Yoshua ben Nun said, Adoni Moshe, I've been with you for so many, many years, there's like nothing in Torah that you haven't already clarified for me. Well, those are fatal words, or fateful words. And essentially, when Moshe Rabbeinu died, it is said that Yoshua ben Nun and Klal Yisrael forgot 3,000 halachos, which means they forgot the answers. Presumably they remembered the questions, otherwise they wouldn't know what they forgot. But they had 3,000 questions that they no longer remembered the answer to. And it says that they wanted to kill Yoshua, because after all, it's his job. He's supposed to be the one that remembers all of this. And he didn't. But it mentions Othniel ben Kenaz was able to restore the answers to these questions through what is called pilpul shel Torah. Now, pilpul here means the use of logic, the use of svara. In other words, there are two different ways Torah gets transmitted. There is direct Mesorah, right? Hashem gave Moshe an answer and it gets passed down. But then, part of the process of Torah Shebal Peh is logic, analogy, differentiation. Right? When you open a piece of, open up a Gemara, much of the Gemara is not dealing with direct answers that Hashem gave Moshe. Much of the Gemara is dealing with the efforts of Chazal to utilize argument and debate and svara in applying it. So Yehoshua forgot some of the direct answers. Now that's plan A. Plan A, optimally, is to have a direct answer from Hashem for every question. But there's a plan B. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Am Yisrael the koach of pilpul. Pilpul is an analysis, svara. Svara is reasoning. To be able to take the principles of Torah and apply them to new cases. This goes on today every time. If a gadol is asked a question, for example, are you allowed to do cloning or surrogate motherhood? The gadol is not trying to figure out, well, what did Hashem tell Moshe about that? Because the short answer is, Hashem did not tell Moshe anything about that. What Hashem told Moshe privately, we don't know, but certainly B'nai Yisrael were not given an answer about surrogate motherhood 4,000 years ago. So what do we mean when we say the oral law was given by Hashem to Moshe? Again, it's an important idea here. Hashem gave Moshe a set of principles and foundational ideas from which the sages of every generation are able to extrapolate what the Ratzon Hashem is in any given case. So the first person who utilized this type of methodology was Othniel ben Kenaz. Othniel ben Kenaz is actually, say again?
I was just thinking,
yeah,
that because
that's
what
right.
You said he was a half-brother, same mother, different fathers.
Right.
Men, according to Hilchos Yerusha, when Khaled dies, he would not inherit because they
that's correct. That's correct.
So then I was thinking he was pretty smart, Khaled. His daughter needed water wells, not dry wells, right? So he gifted the wells during his lifetime to his daughter.
Wow! True.
Therefore, when Aksa dies, Othniel's going to come to
him
anyway.
You know, I didn't think spoken like a true estate lawyer, Baruch Hashem. You're 100%, but really, that's 100% makes sense, because that's the only way, since they're only, Chert says 100% right, and I had never made the connection, but given the fact that Othniel and Kalev are only related by a mother, not a father, Othniel would not be able to inherit Kalev, but this way he's created a mechanism. But Othniel ben Kenaz is the father of the oral law. It's a very important idea, because Moshe Rabbeinu essentially got all of his answers from God. Yehoshua, to a lesser degree, received everything from Moshe. But the concept that when things are forgotten and things are unknown, they can be recreated by the process of logic and reasoning in which we become Hashem's partners in Torah. Othniel ben Kenaz did this. And the Gemara in Temura says that this is the symbolic meaning of conquering Kiryas Sefer. Kiryas Sefer literally means the city of the book. Now, we're not told why it was called Kiryas Sefer. Modern Kiryas Sefer, the name fits because the whole city is one big kollel. That's fine. But why was the ancient city called Kiryas Sefer? You know, we don't know. But the Medrash says it's the notion that he was able to conquer the book, meaning to say that even when we didn't have a book, even when we didn't have a direct answer to the question, he was machzir. He restored the halachos through the koach of pilpul and svara. And it's important to know this because some people labor under a mistake, although it's a religious mistake, that the concept of the oral law means Hashem gave Moshe a precise answer to every single question, and all we're trying to do is recapture what Hashem said to Moshe. That's not really true. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave principles, and he left it to the Chachamim. And that's why the Gemara says, when you have different Chachamim that have different views, even if they're opposites, they both can be right. Now, it's impossible, if you envision Torah Shebal Peh as Hashem telling Moshe a specific answer to a specific question, then by definition, somebody has it wrong. But if you understand, Hashem gives principles, and then leaves it to the Chachamim, to derive conclusions from those principles. Hashem is basically saying, as long as the Chachamim, of course I'm glossing over the question, who are the Chachamim? That's a good question. But as long as the Chachamim use my principles, they get full credit for whatever conclusions they draw from those principles, because it is within the parameters of my principles. That is why Torah Shebal Peh is a creative process, in the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the Chachamim to be actively involved in the promulgation of Emes in the world. That is the meaning, the Ketzos HaChoshen says, of the verse in Tehillim, Emes me'eretz tzmach. Truth emerges from the earth. Hashem, Torah are like the seeds that God planted in the earth, and He wants our work, our contribution, just like a seed. The seed is, you know, comes from Hashem, but we have to nurture it, we have to cultivate it, we have to water it. The creation of halacha comes through human endeavor, in logic, in reasoning. This is why the Mefarshim say that in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, there are two symbols of Torah. There is the Aron HaKodesh, which contains the Luchos. That's Torah Shebichsav. And literally, Torah Shebichsav is etched in stone, unchanging. We have no input into that. The words are what they are. But the second symbol of Torah is the menorah. The menorah, number one, requires a human effort. There is the Ner Tamid, which is Hashem, but we have to light it every day. And the menorah is also ever-changing, the nature of a flame. It flickers, it goes up and down. There are different colors, different nuances, different shades of meaning. That is the dynamism and the interaction of Torah Shebal Peh. So it's not just passive transmission, it is active creation based on the principles of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Asniel ben Kenaz is a historic pivotal figure. And this is that he conquered Kiryas Sefer, meaning he conquered the idea of things were limited to what's in the book, because he was able to be machsir bepilpul halachos that had been forgotten.
But there is a concept of divine Torah Shebaal Peh. These are the principles.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. The divinity of Torah Shebaal Peh represents the fundamental yesodos. Again, because I've heard it said, you know, by well-meaning people, that when, you know, Abaya is arguing with Rava, they are basically just repeating what Hashem said to Moshe. Now, in many ways, that makes no sense. That's almost as if to say, Abaya and Rava were given a script that basically, okay, Abaya, this is what you're supposed to say at this moment. I mean, that's not the way it is. Obviously, these were human beings who are infinitely greater than we are, to be sure, who are analyzing a text and have questions and are raising questions and are giving answers. There's no supernatural thing here in which they are reading from something that pre-existed them. But what they're doing is they are taking the divine principles that Hashem gave to Moshe. And just to digress for a moment, why would Hashem give the Torah that way? Wouldn't it be a neater Torah if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would just give us the answers to everything? There'd be certainly less machlokas.
Everything that's
going to
happen.
Well, all right. So one possibility simply is that would be impossible, because there are new questions every single moment, and it would not be possible to have a direct transmission covering, you know, every possible scenario. Right. So that's what I wanted to bring out, and that is, Hashem wants us to participate. The idea here is this. Let's imagine you want to make a cake for your child, your four-year-old daughter. So the easiest way to make the cake is when she's asleep or in gan, you make the cake. So it'll take you 15 or 20 minutes, put it in the oven, and everything is fine. But a deeper way of showing your love for your child is to make the cake together with your child. Now, in many ways, the cake that you make with your daughter will probably not be of the same quality. The kitchen will be a mess. You could do a much cleaner job yourself. It would be more efficient. The cake might be uneven. There may be an eggshell there, or there may be cocoa on the surface and the like. So you might say, you know, I could just do a better job myself. But the answer is, the love is in the relationship. Torah Shebal Peh is very messy. Gemara is filled with debate, discussion, ambiguity, uncertainty. Gemara is not a code of law, that's for sure. You're not told what to do. You're given many, many opinions, and each opinion has many interpretations, what that opinion means. It's very messy. It's sloppy. But the answer is, Hashem says, I want you to be my partners in Torah. And Othniel ben Kenaz is a very pivotal figure in the creation of Torah Shebal Peh, and that is the meaning of he conquered Kiryas Sefer. And the Gemara goes on and says that when Achsa complains to her father, Kalev, that you gave me dry land, so the Gemara says she was actually a little critical, you gave me this big Talmud Chacham, but he can't produce any income. Meaning to say, he can't make a Parnassa. Give me wells, give me water, give me Parnassa. And if you remember, it says Kalev gave her the upper well, upper spring, Gulot Ilit, Gulot Tachtit. And Kalev's answer is, in the merit of the wells of wisdom he brings down from heaven, you will get Gulot Tachtit, you will get a well from below as well. So it's a very, very beautiful medrash, and Othniel ben Kenaz, therefore, is not only important as the first shofet after Yoshua, but Chazal see him in a very, very critical role. Now, let me make another connection there. Unfortunately, the only Tanakh I have is this big, big, bulky Tanakh. But I want to read you another passage about Othniel ben Kenaz in Divrei Hayamim that you would not know is talking about Othniel ben Kenaz, but Chazal identify him. Divrei Hayamim, by the way, one of the most interesting books in Tanakh, because nobody really knows what it's about, because it either repeats what you already know, in which case why, or it contradicts what you already know, in which case it's a contradiction. So you can't win with Divrei Hayamim, everything is hard, because it's either redundant or contradictory. But because of this, there are many, many, many midrashim that kind of unlock selected passages, but only on a selected basis. The Gemara actually says, maybe it's hyperbole, but the Gemara actually says that there were 400 donkey loads of interpretations on the first 9 chapters in Divrei Hayamim, but all of them got lost. But we have just selected midrashim. And Divrei Hayamim starts off as a book of yichus. It gives lineage of all the different tribes up to the time of Ezra, up to the time of the beginning of the Bayit Sheni. And in Perek Dalet, Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Dalet Pasuk Tes, it's describing the yichus of Bnei Yehuda. You know, Yehuda. Kalev, of course, is mentioned too. Kalev is from Yehuda. But it mentions a man out of nowhere who's nowhere else mentioned, called Yabetz. One of the descendants of Bnei Yehuda was called Yabetz. Jabez in English. And the Pasuk says, Vayehi Yab, this is Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Tes. Vayehi Yabetz Nichbad Meyachav. Yabetz became the most distinguished, the most honored of all of his brethren. The imo kara shmo Yabetz, but his mother had called him Yabetz, which is not such a great name. Lemor ki yoladati biotsev. So Yabetz, transpositioning the beis and the tzaddik, right? Aleph, ayin beis tzaddik could also be ayin tzaddik beis, and that means with sadness or with sorrow or with pain, again reminiscent of Chava's curse. Be'etzev, with pain, travail, teldi banim. Now, it seems to be she had a hard pregnancy. She just called him Yabetz, the one who brought suffering or the one that is a source of suffering. Not the greatest name for a child to bear. But the Pasuk goes on and says, Vayikra Yabetz leloke Yisrael leimor. But Yabetz prayed, called out to Hashem, Im boreich tivorcheni, if you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, will bless me, V'herbesa eskavuli, and you expand my boundaries. V'haisa yadcha imi, and your hand will be with me. V'asisa me'ra'ah, and you will protect me from evil. L'vilti atzvi, so I shall not suffer this sadness. The sentence is not completed. You have to put an ellipsis after the sentence. No, if you do this, etc. And the pasuk just ends, Vayave Elokim Es Asher Sha'al. God gave him everything he asked for. Now, who is Yabetz? What did he ask for exactly, and what did God give him? This is the only reference of Yabetz. Well, there's one other reference I'll mention, but this and one other pasuk is Yabetz in all of Tanakh. So the Medrash tells us that Yabetz is none other than Asniel ben Kenaz. Again, what you're going to discover in Divrei HaYamim is everybody has a million names. All sorts of obscure names of people are people that we know elsewhere. Moshe Rabbeinu is called by different names. Kalev is called by a different name. Miriam is called by a different name. A lot of the enigmatic names that the only people who would know are the people who win the Tanakh, you know, contests here. Names you never even heard of. Usually, they stand for more famous people. And why is Yabetz Asniel? So the Midrashim say that the mother had an intimation. It's a deep idea. That her son would have to struggle in Torah. That we're entering a new realm where we don't simply have direct answers to everything. The Etzev is a remes. She had a premonition. Now, Asniel was presumably born in the desert. He was born, right? He was a young man. He was of the new generation. But she had an understanding that Torah will now require yigia, work, amelus, toil. And that's why she called him Yabetz. And he understood this, but he asked Hashem, if you bless me. So the Gemara explains, he's asking Hashem for the blessing of Torah. And when he says, expand my boundaries, he says, give me students who will learn from me. And that will overcome the sadness that is inherent in the condition of having to work. So this is a whole symbolic thing now. He's not simply saying, I have a bad name, Hashem, let it not be an ayin hara. Rather, there's a recognition that with the death of Moshe and Yehoshua as well, there is a new tekufa in Am Yisrael. And he prays that he should be zocha to teach, to learn Torah, to teach Torah, to have talmidim that will learn from him. And the pasuk ends, Hashem gave him his request. And that's why he is called Nichbad. He is called Nichbad Mikol Beis Aviv, Mikol Achav. He is more honored from all of his brethren, because Chazal say, Ein Kavod Ela Torah, that the honor of a person is his learning and teaching of Torah. That was his kavod. Now, there is one other place where Yabetz is mentioned, and I just want to read you again. There's a midrashic interpretation, and this is going back. This is before this even. Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Beis, Pasuk Nun Hei. Beis Nun Hei, and it reads the following. Again, it's just describing different tribes. Umishbachos Sofrim. There were scribes of Sofrim. Now, Sofrim, you know, in modern Hebrew, we use a sofer to refer to a scribe who writes a Sefer Torah. But in Tanakh, the term is never used in that way. A sofer is a scholar, a Talmud Chacham. And Chazal connected to the idea that they count every letter of the Torah. They see the significance in everything. That's why Chazal are often called Sofrim. Laws that are rabbinic are called Divrei Sofrim, the words of the Torah counters. So it mentions there was a group of great Torah scholars, Yoshvei Yabetz. Now, It's a little strange. If you're learning Divrei Yamim in order, you don't know who Yabetz is yet. Yabetz is not described until two Prakim later. And you might say this Yabetz maybe is a place. Yoshve Yabetz would tend to indicate they dwelt in some town, right? I mean, the simple flow of the Hebrew would be that Yabetz is a location, but Chazal connect Perek Beis with Perek Dalet, and they say these were the students that Yabetz had. These were the students, these were the Sofrim that Yabetz had. And it goes on and it says, they were called Tirasim. Again, all obscure words. Tirasim, Shimasim, Shuchasim. So, again, you read the Pasuk makes no literal sense. Families of scribes who dwelt with Yabetz were called Tirasim, Shimasim, Shuchasim. Again, the simple meaning is this is the name of their families. But Chazal say everything is symbolic. A Tira is an Aramaic word for a gate, a shar. So, Tirasim means those who dwelt in the gateways of the Beis HaMedrash. Tirasim, devoted students of the Beis HaMedrash. Shimasim mean those who were eager to be shomeya, to learn Divrei Torah. And shuchasim, again, shin and sin are interchangeable, so you read it like suchasim, they were willing to dwell in temporary dwellings in order to learn. In other words, they didn't have comfortable homes, but they dwelt in the equivalent of a sukkah. And Yoshve Yabetz means this is the answer to Asniel's prayer that he has Talmidim, right? So you see Chazal are connecting Pas Perek Beis, Pasuk Nun Hei with Perek Dalet. And then it goes on and says something else about this Pasuk. And who were these people? Hema HaKinim. These are the people who are the nation of Kinim. Kinim is with a kuf. Kinim. I'll talk about that. Who come from Hamas. Not the good Hamas here. Name. Avi Beis Rechev. The father of a family called Beis Rechev. Again, I apologize for jumping around here because I want to show you this is one of those areas where you have to examine a lot of psukim. So what is this pasuk telling me in Perek Beis? It's telling me there was a family of scribes, a family of Torah learners, intense Torah learners, who dwelt with Yabetz, and Chazal understand that means they became the Talmidim of Asniel ben Kenaz, who prayed for Talmidim. Remember what the Gemara says about a Rebbe. The Gemara says, more than the calf wants to nurse or wants to suckle, the cow wants to nurse. And that's been said to be the description of a teacher and a student. More than the student wants to learn, the teacher wants to impart. Asniel's prayer in life was he would be zoche to teach Torah. And Hashem answered him with great, great Talmidim who devoted themselves to him, even under physically difficult conditions. But the family is Hamas, the family of Beis Rechev. So the family of these Talmidim are called Beis Rechev. Okay, that's fine. Do we know anything about a family called Beis Rechev in Tanakh? Rechev is a name, obviously it could be connected to a chariot, but the question is there a family? So the answer is there is a family Beis Rechev, and there's a story about the family Beis Rechev. And for this we have to fast forward all the way to the book of Yirmiyahu before the Churban Beis HaMikdash, hundreds of years later. But we're told some biographical details of Beis Rechev that gives us a sense of who this family was. And this is in Perek Lamed Hey of the book of Yirmiyahu. Again, I apologize for the skipping. I normally don't do it this way, but it's interesting to take the different psukim. Yirmiyahu, again, we're skipping now from the period of the Shoftim to the period right before the Churban Beis HaMikdash. That's more than 800 years later. Right? Because The Mikdash was not built till 480 years after they left Mitzrayim, and it stood for 410 years. And in Yirmiyahu Lamed Hey, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling the prophet to tell the people that they're sinful, that if they don't do tshuva, they'll be golos and they'll be chorban, he wants the people to take Musar. And he says to Yirmiyahu, call the family of Beis Rechev and offer them some wine to drink. Just offer them, you know, kosher wine. And Yirmiyahu offers the Beis B'nai Rechev, the family of Rechev, wine. And the family said, we were mekabel from our parents that we don't drink wine. We don't live in homes. They actually were nomads. They were Bedouins. I mean, they were Jewish, but they were Bedouins. They wandered. We wander from place to place in search of Torah learning, to find the best rebbes, different times, the best yeshivas. And as a result, our father told us never to be fixed in one location, to constantly move from place to place in order to find Torah, in order to find inspiration. And our father told us, they became almost like Nazirim. They weren't Nazirim technically. That we don't drink wine because that would cloud our senses, take away our concentration, lead to frivolity. So they were a family, a Jewish family, of nomads. And that's the reference here. They lived in the sukkah. We move from place to place for Torah learning and to live lives of simplicity, lives of humility, lives in which we are removed from the nisyonos of Olam Hazeh. And Yirmiyahu's Musar was, see how faithful the B'nai Rechav are to what their father told him. Why cannot the B'nai Yisrael be so faithful to Hashem's command? So that is the family of B'nai Rechav. And we are told in Divrei Hayamim, going back hundreds of years in the past, that these became the nucleus of the Talmidim of Yabetz, who in turn is Osniel ben Kenaz. Now I have one more surprise to put down the pike. We'll come to that shortly. But
what's the connection to Kenim?
Yeah, because Kenim is the family of Yisro. That's going to be the next thing. Yeah, we'll talk about that. But I just want to set the scene that this is a good, strong example of how sometimes you have to look at many, many psukim. And the psukim are not whole stories. They're like isolated fragments, like a jigsaw puzzle, to put it together to get this picture. Now, the final piece of the puzzle is this. The Mishpachos Sofrim, who are Yoshvei Yabetz, going back to Divrei Hayamim, Perek Beis, they're described as Tirasim. They adhere to the gates of Torah, Tirasim. Shimasim, Lishmoa, they were devoted to learning Torah, hearing Torah. And Shuchasim, which is Suchasim, they were willing to dwell in tents. And that actually ties into Yirmiyahu's description of them as a nomadic people. They are the Beis Rechev family. And we know from Yirmiyahu what that family was. But one other word, as you said, is they are described as kinim. Now kinim, this is not lice, that's what the chav. This is kinim, the keni. Chazal tell us the B'nai Keni are none other than the descendants of Yisro. Yisro, Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, was also a man of many names. Reuel, Chever, Yisro, Chovav, and Keni. And each of the names has a reason. Yisro is connected because he added a parsha to the Torah, because he was the one that gave Moshe Rabbeinu the idea of delegating. Chovav, he loved the Torah. It was beloved to him. Reuel, he became a friend of Hashem. Keni, Cain is like a Khan, is a bird's nest, a nest of protection. He sought protection under Kanfei Hashchina. So Caini actually in the book of Shoftim is the common designation for the Bnei Yisrael. So what's interesting is that Yisrael is described as the highest level of one who comes to Hashem out of pure love. Because Yisrael was wealthy and powerful and influential in Midian, and he gave everything up to be misdabek with Am Yisrael. And his children eventually became known as a family of Bnei Rechav. Bnei Rechav was a certain branch of the family. And the Bnei Rechav became the Talmidim of Asniel ben Kenaz. And in later years, they would wander from place to place to place looking for Torah. And that's the Kinim. The Kinim is the reference to Bnei Yisrael. Yeah. So now that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the following. Well, basically, did Yisrael join Am Yisrael? Did Yisrael not join Am Yisrael? Did he go? Did he not go? Now, one other thing before I get to that, which I'm going to address, let me point out back to the book of Shoftim. This explains the meaning of a pasuk that otherwise doesn't seem to make sense. After we have the story of Asniel ben Kenaz and Achsa asking for a well, and Achsa getting a well, there's a pasuk in Pasuk Desayin that says, the children of Cani, the father-in-law of Moshe, they left the city of Dates, Ir HaTamarim, to be with Bnei Yehuda in the desert. What is that pasuk telling me? It's telling me that initially the Bnei Yisrael were comfortable in the great city of Dates. Ir HaTamarim was, of course, the name for Yericho, a very fertile place. But when the Jews destroyed Yericho, the Cani migrated to the tribe of Yehuda, and according to Divrei Hayamim, they became the students of Asniel ben Kenaz. Okay, that's what it's describing. Now, the question that Lynn raised, though, is a very good question, which indeed I'm going to talk about it now. And that is, there is a contradiction in the Torah, first of all, about Yisrael. Let's take a few questions. Number one, in Parshas Yisrael, Yisrael shows up after the war with Amalek. Yisrael shows up before Matan Torah. This is before the Aseret HaDibros. And Yisrael gives Moshe Rabbeinu guidance and a suggestion about having judges. And then he seems to have gone home. That's in Shmos. I then read in Parshas Baloscha 2 weeks ago, after the Jews were in Har Sinai for almost a year, Moshe asks Yisrael, Lech Imanu, come with us. And you can be a Nayim, you can be our guide in the desert. And all of the good that Hashem will give us, he will give to you. And the pasuk says, by the way, and Yisrael initially says no. Moshe Rabbeinu makes a second request, and the Torah doesn't record the answer. So in Shemos, it says he went back home. But in Shemos, it says everything happened before Matan Torah. In Bamidbar, he's still there a year later, and we don't really know if he went or didn't go, right? So there's a big, big machlokas how to reconcile the contradictions in Shemos with the contradictions in Bamidbar. Some Mefarshim say, actually it's two opinions in the Gemara itself. Some opinions say, Ein muktam umu'ukher b'torah, the Torah is not chronological. The whole story of Yisrael is after Matan Torah. The whole story. Yisrael came after Matan Torah. Now, that still doesn't tell us he went home or not. I'll get to that. But it all happened after Matan Torah. And the only reason the Torah puts it where it puts it is it wants to draw a contrast between Amalek's response to Yetzias Mitzrayim and Yisro's response. Amalek sees a Kriyas Yamsuf and the Ten Makos, and Amalek attacks. And Amalek wants to destroy, and Amalek wants to deny Hashem. And Yisro sees it, and Yisro is inspired, albeit Yisro didn't come until later. Now, let's just take the implications of that, just in terms of chronology. If we assume everything happened later, then that pasuk in Shmos is giving the answer, because the pasuk basically says, Moshe asked Yisro to come, Yisro said no, and Yisro went back to his country. In other words, the pasuk in Shmos says Yisro went back to his country. But Midbar doesn't say that. So one reading is Yisro went back to Midian, and Yisro did not come to Eretz Yisrael. Now, the obvious problem with that is, if Yisro did not come to Eretz Yisrael, why do we find the B'nai Keni in Eretz Yisrael if Yisro didn't come? So some Mefarshim actually learn. The Radak brings this. The Radak actually says the B'nai Keni were not in Eretz Yisrael because of Moshe, but since they were a Bedouin nation, they happened to have found themselves in Eretz Yisrael, and they were from Midian. They wander around. They just wander around. And they happen to have gotten there. So that's pshat number one. Everything happened after Matan Torah, and Yisro did not come to Eretz Yisrael. Chazal learned differently. Chazal do learn that Yisro did come to Eretz Yisrael. He was the Einayim. He was the guide. And that is why there's a reference to all the kindness that Yisro did. And when it says he went back to his country, Rashi says that was a temporary going back to be Megayer B'nai Mishpachto.
When did
Moshe marry Tzipporah before? Because Moshe was... That's correct.
To marry Tzipporah, he had to have met Yisro.
Well, he... No, of course he met Yisro. I'm talking... That's for sure. So again, what I'm saying is there are two pshat. Again, right now we're going with the view that everything happened after Matan Torah. If everything happened after Matan Torah, you have to take the pasuk that Yisro went back to his land, which is in Shmos, and read it in Bamidbar. But then we have a machlokes. Does that mean he literally went back and the B'nai Keni only came there via being a Bedouin? But of course, eventually they had to convert because they're described as the Talmidim of Yabetz. But the conversion would have occurred at a later time in history. Or the alternative is Rashi's pshats that the B'nai Yisro, Yisro went to his land to be Megayer, his people, and then he brought them back, and he was the Einayim, he rejoined the Jewish people in the Midbar, and he and his children entered Eretz Yisrael, and the like. Now, there is another view that Yisro did come before Matan Torah, but that really doesn't change that much, because even if Yisro came before Matan Torah, it's clear that he stayed until after Matan. In other words, the issue is not when he went back to his land. That for sure has to be after Matan Torah, because that's in Bamidbar. He may have come before. It's interesting, just as a little ha'ara, again, I have more to say about this, we'll save it for next week, but I just want to mention one little ha'ara, that the Malbim offers a very interesting interpretation of Yisro, because the Malbim points out that in Parshas Yisro, Yisro gives Moshe Rabbeinu the idea of appointing judges. And if you learn that's before Matan Torah, Yisro gave him that idea before Matan Torah. But in the book of Devarim, when Moshe Rabbeinu is reviewing the history of the Jewish people, he seems to say it was only after Matan Torah, when we had to leave Har Sinai, that I started appointing judges. So if Yisro is after Matan Torah, that fits. But if Yisro is before Matan Torah, Yisro gave him the idea before, but he didn't implement it until after. And the Malbim suggests that explains a certain discrepancy. Because when Yisro told Moshe to appoint judges, Yisro emphasized only moral qualities. Anshei Emes, people of truth. Yirei Elokim, people who are God-fearing. People who are Sonei Betza, people who hate bribes. Of course, you know the old joke. I think it may be a Ben-Gurion joke, I'm not sure, but it's an old Yiddish joke too. It's in a lot of places. Somebody says, where are you going to find people who are, you know, Yirei Elokim, Sone Betza? Where are you going to find them? So the answer is, for money you can get anybody. But the thing is, Yisro emphasized moral qualities. And he told Moshe, appoint judges that have moral qualities. In the book of Devarim, Moshe says, Havu lachem, you, the Jewish people, should appoint judges that are chachamim, wise, nivonim, with understanding. This emphasizes intellect and knowledge. So note the two differences. In Yisro, Moshe is given the responsibility. In Devarim, Bnei Yisrael are given the responsibility. In Yisro, the qualities are moral. In Devarim, the qualities are intellectual. Yisro, the suggestion is before Matan Torah. Devarim, after Matan Torah. When they left Har Sinai, they left Har Sinai. Three differences. So the Malbim says, a wonderful, wonderful thought. The Malbim says the following. The Malbim says, the qualifications of a judge before Matan Torah are going to be different than after Matan Torah. Before Matan Torah, there literally was no fixed body of law that had to be applied. You didn't have to know a lot. There wasn't a lot to know. There wasn't a Choshen Mishpat. There wasn't a Parshas Mishpatim. A judge would adjudicate based on fairness, based on equity, based on Yosher. So in Yisro's advice, Yisro doesn't have to tell Moshe, find judges that know many, many laws. There is not a lot of laws to know. But you have to have people of truth, people of integrity, people who are not corrupted. So Yisro emphasizes moral qualifications. Because in truth, there was no need for Torah learning as such, because there was no learning before. At least in terms of halakha, there was no detailed halakha before Matan Torah. That is why Yisro emphasizes moral qualities. But moral qualities, you need a Moshe Rabbeinu to ascertain. Because although the average person might be able to gauge if someone is learned, although I'm not so sure of that, but the Malbim suggests that, you know, you could tell that somebody knows his stuff, but the quality of a person's heart and the quality of a person's neshama, you need a Moshe Rabbeinu to be able to ascertain. Now, once the Torah is... But Moshe didn't implement it till after Matan Torah. Now, after Matan Torah, you still need the moral qualities, to be sure. But there is now another requirement that a person have great, deep knowledge of all the halachas. And that is why there's the split. But that could be determined by Bnei Yisrael. So essentially, what Moshe is saying is, you, Bnei Yisrael, choose the Talmidei Chachamim, and from that group, I will choose the Yirei Elokim, the Anshei Emes, the Sonei Betza. So according to the Malbim, the idea of Yisrael was, he gave his idea pre-Matan Torah. Moshe did not implement it until before the Jews were about to leave. I'm sorry, yeah, question.
Where does this Kayan fit into
that? Okay, that's a very good point. And it's important. A lot of people get confused here. The Zakenim have nothing to do with Yisro. In other words, like this. The Zakenim are the 70 elders who will succeed Moshe Rabbeinu in leadership, and they will augment Yahushua. The Yisro thing are subordinate courts in the lifetime of Moshe Rabbeinu who will adjudicate cases. In other words, like this. The Zakenim are not until the 40th year. But the courts, the court system, is right after Matan Torah. Okay, so that's a different system. That's Yisro's idea. The 70s of Canaan is not from Yisro. That is separate. Okay? Now, one final thing that's a little difficult, though. That if you understand Chazal's approach, which Rashi brings, that the Bnei Yisro himself converted and brought his family over, and they are the Cani who lives in Eretz Yisrael, there are a few psukim that are difficult, because you will find throughout Tanakh, and we'll go over this next time, that Every time the Jews are about to destroy a city, they always send a warning if there are any Canaan around that please leave the city so you won't be destroyed because we have a lot of Hakaras HaTov to you. That's a very strange way of speaking if you're dealing with fellow Jews. For example, the War of Amalek. At some point, the Canaan were living around Amalek. And when Shaul was commanded to eradicate Amalek, a message was sent to the Cani to evacuate. But it just sounds very funny. It's not, I mean, the way you would talk to a fellow Jew is not, you know, please evacuate so you shouldn't get killed because we owe you Hakaras HaTov. I mean, if it's another Jew, you say, you know, get out. So that actually implies, like the Radak suggests, that the Cani, in fact, were not Jewish. They were non-Jews living in Eretz Yisrael who had a special relationship with Am Yisrael because of Hakaras HaTov, and as a result, it was the universal practice that the Cani were always given opportunities to leave. On the other hand, we have the other passage about the B'nai Cani with the Talmidim of Yabetz. Now, that might suggest, instead of Yisrael converting, it might suggest that different groups, some parts of B'nai Yisrael became Jewish and some parts didn't. This is what the Radak says. But again, Rashi seems to suggest that Yisrael was Megayer the whole family and came to Eretz Yisrael, unless Rashi means Ger Toshav, which is a possibility. Sometimes a Ger could mean a non-Jew who accepts the seven commandments of Noach. It does not necessarily mean totally Jewish. So there's a lot of questions here. Yeah?
Yeah, it's just a
pain,
the one that killed Sisro.
That's exactly right.
Sisro went into her tent, so she would have been, he would have thought that she was part of B'nai Yisrael.
That's right, that's right. That's yet another proof. The simple implication is that Chever HaKeni was not Jewish, but he was a Ger Toshav who accepted the seven mitzvahs. So it seems that to me, again, I mean, I'm not one to be machria, the most logical way of putting everything together is that Yisro did come into Eretz Yisrael with Klal Yisrael. He was Lianayim, he was a guide, he was a leader, but they did not become Jewish, they were Gerei Toshav, righteous non-Jews. As a result, they were always given advance warning of any military campaign, but there was a segment of B'nai Yisro, the family of Beis Rechev, who did convert to Judaism, and they became the devoted Talmidim of Asniel ben Kenaz, and for hundreds of years they were nomads, mimakum lamakum for Torah, and they didn't drink wine. That would be the simple pshat. Whether you can fit that into Rashi, who says Yisro was Megayer the family, is not clear, but this is what the Radak suggests, and I think it does fit the psukim very well. Yeah?
I was under the impression that the city of Yericho was given to the descendants of Yisro,
yes,
as Yerusha until the time the Beis Hamikdash would be built,
yep,
and then it becomes a city of
Levim. Yes, that's exactly correct. But the question becomes: did they get it as Jews or as non-Jews? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. No, but you had said that they left it when the Jews entered Eretz Yisrael and they conquered Jericho.
Right.
Yeah.
So I might have misspoken. You're correct. Rashi actually brings the Medrash that Yericho was settled by B'nai Yisro until the Beis Hamikdash was built. But when the Pasuk says in Shoftim, they left Yericho, it is a reference to the Talmidim who followed Asniel ben Kenaz. Meaning
so
to
it's
say,
not the entire
that's correct. There were B'nai Yisro who remained in Yericho, but the devoted Tirasim, Shimasim, Suchasim, they left the Gashmias, the comfort of Yericho, to go to the deserts of Yehuda to learn Torah with Asniel ben Kenaz. Yeah. Right, so then you have a problem. That's a general problem. Since Yericho was destroyed and nobody's allowed to live in Yericho, again, modern Yericho may not be exactly ancient Yericho, so how could they live there? So again, we have to learn. The Lashon of the Gemara is Dushne Shel Yericho, that means the fertile soils around Yericho. So just like Chevron, right? We always say that. Just like Kalev didn't get Chevron, Kalev got the suburbs of Chevron. So the B'nai Cani got the area around Jericho. Jericho per se was destroyed. You're not allowed to rebuild it. That's the story of Chiel, right? Chiel is a fellow who built Jericho, and he tried to build Jericho. All of his children died as a result. But according to Rashi's pshat, therefore, that's the connection to Asniel. The people who left were the Talmidim who followed. And again, that's again a Mesiras Nefesh. Jericho was prosperous. Jericho was comfortable. And they went into the desert, like Ofakim, whatever it is, to learn Torah with Asniel ben Kenaz. Okay? So as I say, so the story of Yisro is quite a complicated story just to figure it out. There are a lot of different interpretations. We don't even know if Yisro came to Eretz Yisrael. We don't know if it was a Ger Tzedek or Toshav. There are indicators in both directions. And the most plausible interpretation is that Yisro came to Eretz Yisrael as a Ger Toshav. And many of his descendants were non-Jewish, but they were righteous, and they were always given warning. But a certain subdivision of Bnei Yisrael became the Bnei Rechav family, and they became the great Talmidim of Asniel ben Kenaz. Yeah.